Anne Rehm, Tragedy strikes early in a new novel by Ayelet Waldman. In a charming village in coastal Maine, a young couple dies on the day of their wedding. The people who love them most have to learn to live with this seemingly insurmountable sorrow that follows. A marriage unravels. Families collide. Siblings of the bride and groom make questionable choices. But throughout the story, there are moments of great tenderness and hope, and unexpected insights and friendships that perhaps could only be born of heartbreaking grief. The novel is titled Red Hook Road, and Ayelet Waldman joins me in the studio. I do invite your calls and comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Ayelet. I'm glad to have you here.
Oh, good morning. It's such a pleasure to be on the show. I've been a listener for a very long time.
Oh, I'm so glad. Ayelet, I know you got the kernel for an idea for this novel from a short newspaper article. Tell us about that.
It's always interesting where you get your ideas. People always ask writers that, where do you get your ideas? And I find that, you know, if you're receptive, you can find them really anywhere. And I was reading the newspaper one day, a long time ago, and I saw just the tiniest little squib. It wasn't a long piece. It was just a little sort of one paragraph article about a bride and a groom and also the best man who were in a limousine going from the church to the reception of the wedding, and a drunk driver hit the limo, and they were all three killed. And it was something about that story. I mean, I think that's sort of the difference between writers and normal people. You know, a normal person reads that and thinks, what a terrible tragedy.
Right.
A writer reads it, has that response for a few seconds, and then thinks, oh my goodness, this would make a perfect first scene for a book.
If you would read for us from the coda for the book.
Absolutely, with pleasure. The group photograph finally accomplished to his satisfaction. The photographer dismissed the members of the wedding party. It took a few minutes for them to disperse, for the bridemaids to kiss the air next to the bride's cheek, for the bride's parents to hug both her and the groom close, as though in a few minutes they were not all going to see one another down the road at the reception, for the bride's grandfather to be helped down the church steps, for the disgraced flower girl to be bundled into the back seat of the car belonging to the mother of the groom. Once everyone was gone, the photographer led the bride and groom to the far end of the churchyard, to an opening in the hedge of thickly blooming rugosa. "Mind your dress," the photographer said. He slipped through the opening and down the short, steep slope to the beach, hustling a little, eager to catch the money shot, the bride stepping through the hedge, a burst of pink flowers on either side of her. She was about to leap the few feet from the break in the hedge down to the beach when the photographer called, "Why don't you let him go first and lift you down?" The photographer had shot four weddings at this church this summer alone, and he knew this was not only the best way to avoid damage to the dress, but would also make for two more pretty pictures, one of the groom lifting his pretty bride and the other of him setting her down gently on the beach. He had underestimated this bride, however, and thus was caught off guard when she did not wait for her groom's hand to gently span her waist, but leaped, laughing, into his arms. They tumbled backward, and the groom landed on the rocks, the bride splayed out in his lap. The photographer managed to press the shutter a few times before rushing to help them to their feet. The bride and groom laughed. They took no notice of the wet stain on the seat of the groom's pants, or of the ribbon of seaweed that trimmed the hem of the bride's dress. When they were on their feet, the photographer pointed a few yards up the beach. "If you stand there," he said, "I can get the church spire in the frame." The bride and groom obediently went to the indicated spot. They resisted, however, his efforts to position them with the bouquet between them, the bride staring up into the groom's face, her veil trailing over her shoulder. Instead, the groom nuzzled the bride's neck, making her laugh again, and the photographer took the picture, even though he knew that in the end she would not like seeing herself with her mouth open so wide you could see her back teeth. For the next 15 minutes or so, we had them move this way and that until he was finally satisfied that he had what he needed. "Okay," he said, "we're all set. Let's head over to the reception." "Why don't you go on ahead?" the groom said. "We'll catch up in a minute." When he reached the churchyard, the photographer snapped on his telephoto lens and, crouching so that he was shooting through the opening in the rugosa hedge, took one last photograph of the bride and groom. This photograph, the couple in the distance on the rocky beach, the bride's dress and veil blowing out in the sudden gust of breeze, the whole picture framed by the blurry pink of the out-of-focus rugosa blossoms, won him first prize and $1,000 in the annual photography contest sponsored by New England Bride magazine. On his entry form, he declined to mention, not wishing to adversely affect his chances, that behind the pretty picture, though you could not see or guess at it, there lay a tragic tale. The bride and groom took the long way around and back up to the church, both so that they would not have to scramble up the steep slopes to the churchyard in their wedding finery, and so that they could spend a few more minutes alone before they were thrust into the adoring throng of their friends and family. The bride hitched up her wide skirt with one hand, and with the other clasped her new husband's hand. She held his hand the way she and her sister had always held their father's, grasping his ring and middle fingers and letting his pinky index finger and thumb rest on the outside of her closed fist. The groom lifted their joined hand to his lips and kissed her knuckle. "I love you," he said. The bride smiled. "I love you too." "I know," the groom said. They reached the church where their limousine waited for them, taking up two parking spaces and even so thrusting its rear bumper halfway into the road. The groom helped the bride into the back of the limousine, taking care not to close her voluminous gown in the door. They backed out onto Red Hook Road. 4 minutes later, the bride and groom heard the sound, the explosive boom, the metallic shriek, but what they saw was only a froth of lace and tulle swirling in the air around them. The wedding dress, its crinolines, the veil, clung to their faces, wrapping them in a soft white cocoon.
The book is titled Red Hook Road. It's a novel by Ayelet Waldman. Do join us, 800-433-8850. You painted that picture so beautifully. How long after you had read that in the newspaper did you finally begin working on the book?
A couple of years. You know, it sat in the back of my mind for a long time. Just kind of gelling and sitting. That's one of the things I think that the luxury of being able to allow that to happen, to take time before you write something, is really the novelist's luxury. And, you know, I've written essays and I've written blog posts. And the thing that is most wonderful about writing novels is that it takes a long time to write a novel and it takes a long time for an idea to turn into a novel idea. So it was a few years between the time I read that and the time that I began work on this novel.
But somehow you must have seen that picture.
Absolutely. I mean, that
in
was
your mind.
That coda is what lodged, and that wasn't described. I have no idea what went on inside that limousine and it was in Queens, it wasn't in Maine, but for some reason when I read that little squib in the newspaper, that image of the white lace, of the tulle, of all of that frothing inside, that prettiness and kind of spring-like glow of a bride inside the horror of that, of the car accident and the metal and the terrible noise, that's what stuck with me.
So the bride and groom are gone.
Yeah.
But because the family has been so involved in so many ways, the bride and groom connect those two families.
Absolutely. I mean, they knit these two families together who never would have been knit together otherwise.
Because one is
a family of summer visitors from New York City, Jewish. They come every summer to Maine. And the other is a local family, you know, from Maine, from as long as there have been people, you know, Europeans in Maine. And they're not only different, and they are very, very different, but there's also the two mothers have always had a very complicated, difficult, conflicted relationship. Iris, who's the mom from New York, and Jane.
She's the mother of the bride.
She's the mother of the bride, yes, and Jane, the mother of the groom. You know, they've known each other for a long time. I mean, Jane has been cleaning Iris's house for a very, very long time. And they're both very strong women. They both have a very deep sense of who they are. And they have they've never liked each other. Part of it has to do with class. Part of it has to do with who they are as people. Part of it has to do with they're prickly. They're both prickly women, and they've kind of prickled up against each other for a long time.
And Iris was not terribly happy that her daughter was going to marry Jane's son.
No, absolutely not. I mean, Iris had a very clear vision of what her daughter was supposed to be. Becca, who's the daughter, was a violin player, and she had been in conservatory, and she abandoned what Iris imagined was going to be a very serious musical career in order to move to Maine and live with her boyfriend and marry him. And Iris feels like she betrayed all the possibility that Iris had invested in her. And Jane also was not so thrilled. I mean, Jane didn't want to see her son tied down to this family of, there's a phrase in Maine, from away, people who are from away. And Jane had no interest in seeing her son bogged down in this family of from away. She felt like they were always going to see him as somehow second class, that they were, she anticipated Iris's disapproval and adopted it as her own. So this marriage, you know, Iris and Jane both liked the children. You know, they liked each other's partner, but they were not happy to have these two families knit together. And the irony is the children are gone, and it's the knitted families that remain.
Red Hook Road is the title of the novel. Ayelet Waldman is the author. And whether you've read the book or not, I do hope you'll join us by phone, by email, on Facebook or Twitter.
Good morning. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Tonight at 6 on Snap Judgment, Tales from the Library. The whole range of human experience isn't just cataloged in a library. It actually takes place inside. That's Snap Judgment, Tales from the Library, tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5. Mostly sunny skies today, high in the upper 80s, 78 right now in northwest Washington. It's 10:19.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And here's our first email from Jennifer, who lives in Concord, New Hampshire. She says, I just heard the author read the coda to the book, and I'm crying at my desk.
Oh,
such
Jennifer,
powerful
thank you.
Imagery. I'm drawn in, and now I must read this book. Also, because I'm from a small town in Maine.
Oh.
Fabulous.
Oh, that's
says.
Wonderful.
It is. And what I want to ask you, you've written so powerfully about loss. What about loss in your own life?
Well, you know, I have been curious in writing about this for a long time. And, you know, I think we've all experienced losses.
Of course.
We've all the most profound experience for me personally was I had my best friend was killed in a very tragically, very young, in a plane crash. And you know, I tried to write about that once. I tried to actually write about her name was Amanda Davis. She was a phenomenal writer. Her last book was called, horribly ironically, Wonder When You'll Miss Me, and I really recommend it. It's a beautiful book. But I tried to write about that experience, and I couldn't actually write it in a way that felt authentic and that didn't feel like I was sort of somehow taking advantage of her memory. So I pushed that away. But when I was writing about what Iris and Jane were experiencing, that the feelings that I had in the wake of Amanda's death and in the years after, I mean, Amanda died 2 weeks before my youngest son was born. So I'm always very conscious of how long it's been since she died, and sort of the passing of time and how young she remains as all of us age. And so that experience, I mean, I think that's one of the things, one of the wonderful things about writing novels is that you get to take the emotional truth and write it in a way that feels true emotionally but doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the actual facts.
You also lost a child.
Yeah, not in the way that Iris and Jane did, of course. And not, and what happened to us is that I was pregnant with a very much wanted baby, and halfway through the pregnancy, we found out through amniocentesis that the baby had genetic anomalies, and we made a decision to terminate that pregnancy, which is very different than having your baby die.
But very difficult.
Yes, I'd always been pro-choice. I still am pro-choice. The experience of having ended that pregnancy knocked me off, you know, just completely knocked me for a loop. And I went through 6 months of really profound depression and sadness. And I kind of wrote, I was sort of writing in circles around that experience over and over again. And I wrote about losing a child, losing a baby in Love and Other Impossible Pursuits. I wrote a very weird ghost story about a woman haunted by the ghost of her dead baby, which was very peculiar in an anthology for McSweeney's. And then I wrote this book, which is about what happens after, which is how you heal. And I think finally, you know, all these years later, I've actually written my way out of those emotions and out of that experience. And I don't think I'll be writing about that so clearly again.
Tell us about Iris. She is an extraordinarily domineering mother who does not in any way hold back her desire to dominate the people around her, including her husband, including her children. Not an easy woman at all.
Iris is the me I fear I am. You know, I mean, I have that tendency. You know, I can be very, very bossy. I am absolutely convinced that I know best. I know in my heart that if everybody did, from everybody, from Barack Obama, from the President of the United States down to my children, if they just listened to me, everything would be fine. We would have sealed the leak in the Gulf. My children would have gotten into exactly the schools. Just listen to me, please. But you know, I try in my life to sort of back away from those incredible feelings of domination and maybe allow other people to express the occasional point of view. But Iris, I just let her rip with Iris. I
you
let her be
really
that person.
Did. I mean, she wants to control her poor husband.
I know. Poor Daniel. But you know what? I think that's what Iris has to learn in this book is that you can't control everyone. And not only can't you control them, but you don't want to control them. Because when everyone is doing your bidding, it leads to a very hollow life. I still don't know that I believe that, though. I still feel if everyone just did what I told them, things would be so perfect.
What about Jane? You've said that she's your favorite character.
Yes. Jane and the grandfather, Mr. Kimmelbrot, are my favorite characters. I love Jane. Jane was an exercise in seeing if I could write someone who is as different from my personal experience as, you know, someone who lives in Burkina Faso almost. I mean, I wanted, you know, I'm a Jewish girl who grew up in New Jersey, and Jane is a New Englander through and through. We are totally different people. And I really wanted to see if I could write that character and find the commonalities between us and write her in a way that felt authentic and real.
She, though she runs a successful business,
yes,
Iris still looks down on her.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, what is her business? She's a domestic. She runs a cleaning company. And it's complicated because Iris doesn't want to look down on her. Iris knows that she should respect Jane because Jane is a businesswoman. She's, you know, she supports her family. She kicked out her abusive husband long ago. But still, Iris has this vestiges of this kind of class feelings and looks down on Jane because Jane isn't educated, because Jane doesn't, you know, because she does this domestic work.
Jane is also someone who very much adored her son, Iris certainly adored her daughter, but Iris is a feminist, strong feminist, who felt that her daughter, Becca, should not take her husband's name.
Absolutely.
And you come to this scene in the cemetery, and what happens?
Well, Iris has ordered the gravestone, and because they're Jewish, they've had the unveiling a year. In the Jewish tradition, you unveil the gravestone a year after the person has died. And it's time for the unveiling, and the family is collected, and they take off the curtain from the grave marker, and it has Iris's, as Becca's name as Becca Kopeikin, which is Iris's and her husband's name. And Ruthie, Iris's daughter, is horrified because she knew that her sister had planned to take the last name. Tetherly had planned to take her husband's name, and she can't believe that Iris has done this. And Iris didn't. We almost didn't do it on purpose. She had a moment after she'd already ordered the graves marker that she thought, "Wait a minute, did I?" But in her mind, she says, "Well, they hadn't had time to change their name. Maybe Becca would have made a different choice. The grave marker is supposed to be there for the people who survive, and we knew her as Becca Kopeikin. We never knew her as Becca Tetherly." So she feels like she's made a very logical and emotionally true decision, and to her daughter Ruthie, the younger sister of Becca, it feels like an absolute betrayal.
What happens between Iris and her husband?
Well, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon that losing a child is one of the most profound challenges to a marriage. I mean, many, many marriages do not survive that loss, and their marriage it falters. I mean, it brings out all, you know, when you are so emotionally devastated, it brings out all the emotions that were there to begin with. Becca's death doesn't ruin the marriage. The marriage was ruined before. Becca's death allows that marriage to finally express its truth, which is that you know, it's been a nightmare for a long time. It's been and being married to Iris has been really hard on Daniel, and they haven't been satisfying one another, and they can't move on separately or together.
I want to move to an essay you wrote for the New York Times that got you in such trouble.
Oh, it sure did, didn't it?
When you said that you loved your husband, and correct me if I'm using the wrong language, but that you loved your husband more than you loved your children.
That's the right language. That's
okay.
What I said.
Tell me why you said that, and what happened afterwards.
Well, some friends of mine were putting together a literary anthology, and you know how very infrequently those are read. I mean, you know, they're people don't buy them, people don't read them. Anyway, they called me and they said, "Okay, we're doing a literary anthology about motherhood, and we've got women, mothers writing about divorce, and mothers writing about having sons, and mothers writing about surviving cancer, and we need a mother to write about sex. And since you're the only mother we know who's having any, that's your job." So I set out to write a kind of lighthearted how to maintain an intimate relationship with your husband after you have four children. And I ended up, because I can turn anything into a sort of a treatise on guilt and shame, I wrote this piece about how all these good mothers weren't having sex with their husbands because they had transferred all of their passion and ardor to their children. And that because I had somehow hadn't done that. I loved my children, but I wasn't in love with them. And if I had to make a hierarchy, if I had to say, you know, if a good mother is a mother who loves her children more than anyone else in the world, well, then I'm a bad mother because I still love my husband more than my children. And then it got picked up by the New York Times. And I never thought to myself, what is the difference between having, five people read this essay in a literary anthology and 5 million people read it? And it turns out the difference is a lot of email, a lot of TV, a lot of craziness. And I ended up all over the place.
Tell me what happened when you went on the Oprah show.
Well, I went on the Oprah show. I went on sort of thinking it was going to be Oprah and me, and we were going to talk about how much we agreed with me, and it was going to be so easy. And it turns out they assembled a couple of dozen people. And as we were as I was listening to this cacophony of female voices shrieking somewhat like, you know, Macbeth, the witches passing their eyeball back and forth. And I said to the producer, I said, what is that? And she said, well, we have a couple of dozen people and they hate you. But hey, you are a criminal defense attorney. You're used to hostile juries. You'll be fine. And it was amazing. I mean, there were a couple of women on the stage who agree with me. There were mostly women who didn't. The audience was full of women who thought that I was, you know, the worst mother they'd ever experienced in their lives. It was terrifying. But I will say this. Oprah is incredible, and she had my back. And because she's so amazing and convincing, this audience of women who, no joke, wanted to tear me limb from limb, by the end of the show, they were saying, oh, we agree totally with Ayala. She's right. Yes, we just didn't like the way she said it.
Didn't somebody
They brought me out on the stage, and they were selecting women to be on the stage, to come like from the audience to actually sit on the stage with me. And they selected this one woman, and she was so excited to be selected that she leapt out of her seat yelling, let me at her. And that was the first thing I heard when I walked on the soundstage, and I thought, oh no, I cannot believe that this is what's going to happen. But then I'm telling you, you know, what saved it from being a Jerry Springer episode was Oprah's unbelievable power over her audience. I mean, she's a magician.
Ayala Waldman, and her new novel is titled Red Hook Road. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to, is it Ocala, Florida, Bob? Am I getting that right?
Yes, it's Ocala, sometimes known as Slocala.
Okay, go right ahead.
Yes. Oh, okay, well, Diane, thank you very much for having me on.
Sure.
And having such wonderful guests all the time.
Good.
And I cannot wait to read this book.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
This is that you read. I'm going out to buy it today.
Yay!
I'm finishing up with Eat, Love, Pray. Eat, Pray, Love. You are very much next. I love your writing style. And I can't wait to find out how this control freak deals with this situation. It's amazing. And on a personal note, you know, there's lots of different types of grief and everything. One thing that I found with myself when I underwent grief was, you know, the power of friendship. My friends really got me through it by being there and, you know, just letting me vent and talk and cry and being supportive and being there and making sure that I wasn't, you know, wallowing in it and, you know, being by myself all the time, which is kind of what I wanted to do. But also they were very responsive that I did need my own space and my own time and everything. And so they allowed me that space and everything. So
friends can be the most valuable resource in the whole wide world.
Absolutely.
When grief strikes.
Absolutely. And I think that's in this book I wanted to show that, you know, it's Iris and Jane who, once they allow themselves to experience that, once they allow themselves to connect, that's really what allows them to heal.
When you were growing up, what was your own relationship with your mother like?
I love my mother. My mother is wonderful. My mother's an old school feminist. You know, I remember when I was a little girl, she had a consciousness raising group that included, troublingly, my second grade teacher, not necessarily my third grade teacher, not necessarily something you want to see when you're a little girl, but she was a phenomenal role model. But, you know, my mother and I are both strong, dominant women. And like all strong, dominant women, we clashed periodically. We still do. But having that kind of role model, having the role model of a mother who went out to work from the time I was tiny, who expected me to have a career and expected me to achieve a certain amount of success was both difficult, but also ultimately was, you know, it's the reason that I am who I am.
Hmm. And what's it like for you to be married to a very successful writer?
Well, you know, it's funny. Everyone wants me to say that I'm so jealous and that we feel a competition. But, you know, I think my husband is one of the best writers in the English language
today.
And
we should say who he is.
His name is Michael Chabon. He's the author of The Yiddish Policeman's Union, among many other books. He's brilliant. For me to try to compete would be ridiculous. But we have an incredibly supportive, wonderful writing relationship. I mean, nothing leaves the house that we haven't edited. I edit all his work. He edits all mine. I mean, down to the ridiculous where it's almost sometimes we edit each other's emails. It's also that, you know, writing is the family business. So we're always talking about our work. We're always passing around ideas. We're always sort of picking apart things. Our kids now have gotten into the act. They'll sort of sit at the table. Recently, my 7-year-old told me that an idea was missing shawow. He was right. It was missing some shawow.
Ayala Waldman. Her new novel is titled Red Hook Road. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more of your calls, your comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11. Tonight at 6, it's Snap Judgment, Tales from the Library. The whole range of human experience isn't just cataloged in a library, it actually takes place inside. Snap Judgment, Tales from the Library, tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5. Complete schedules are on our website, WAMU.org.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, unlocking secrets of the past and the future. First, discoveries at the site of a former slave village in Maryland shine light on local life in early America. Then, how new brain cell discoveries could transform treatment on everything from Alzheimer's to HIV. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
You value WAMU 88.5 as a shared community resource. Help support it. Your membership contribution will help yourself as well as the entire community by keeping valuable programs on the air. Call 800-248-8850 or give online at WAMU.org.
Mostly sunny skies today, a high in the upper 80s, becoming partly cloudy overnight, a low in the upper 60s. Sunny tomorrow, high in the low 90s, and then very hot this week. Sunny and hot on Tuesday, a high in the upper 90s. Right now, 80 degrees, partly cloudy skies in northwest Washington. It's 10:38.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And if you've joined us just now, Ayala Waldman is with me. You know her, I'm sure, because she is the author of 10 novels, one nonfiction work called Bad Mother. She lives in Berkeley, California, with her husband, the novelist Michael Chabon, and their 4 children. She has a brand new novel titled Red Hook Road, and it really does hook you right from the beginning. Let's take another call here in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
Thank you so much.
Surely.
Opportunity. In 07, I lost my older brother.
Oh, dear.
He passed away in his sleep.
Oh.
Yeah, and it was two
I'm
days
so
after
sorry,
Christmas.
Doug.
And he was mentally challenged, so I only knew him through visits growing up.
Mm.
6 months later, I lost my mother.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have to tell you, ladies, I found out the true definition of grief.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, that, and it was, and I didn't know. It, you know, my brother, I knew him only as a sibling, but my mother, she raised 4 of us by herself. Mm. I knew her, and I lived with her for 10 years. So I knew her as a, you know, as somebody very important in my life. And the privacy of it, the torment of it, and I'm partnered with somebody of 13 years, and it nearly wrecked our relationship.
Huh.
Because I could not, I didn't want him to get near me. I didn't want him to be near. I just wanted to be left alone.
Yes, I understand.
And yeah, it was very, very. I'm definitely going to get this book.
I think
I'm a writer myself, so I was listening to the beginning of the story, and I was like, "Oh my goodness!"
Well, and I think you will understand how the fullness of grief affects not only the individuals most closely involved, but the entire community.
Absolutely.
Is affected by the death of this young couple on their wedding day.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the experience of their families, the most intense, but it trickles outward towards everybody who touches them. I mean, what I think can be really transformative about these experiences is that no matter how different we are, no matter what backgrounds we come from, no matter where we live, this experience of loss, of grief, is common. You know, it can transcend any difference. And I think, you know, one of the ways to look at it is that you can identify with anybody. You can share the grief of anybody because you've experienced yourself.
Here's an email from a man who identifies himself as a retired Episcopal priest. He says, "I almost lost it while working in the garden, hearing the sentences describing the photographing scenes just prior to the accident, having shared in numerous weddings. I know personally how poignant every moment of the wedding day can be. The beautiful daughter of my father's medical school classmate was killed with her fiancé just days before her wedding in 1959. Oh. And I thought about her unexpectedly over the years. Curiously, I just found a photo of her from 1959 in my mother's effects after her death this past December. And Sonia was just as lovely as I remembered her as a young man half a century ago."
I mean, that's remarkable. 50 years later, that is so clear in his memory and so vivid. It really speaks to the profound, the connection between marriage and grief, and it's really remarkable.
And here on another subject is a message from Charlotte, who says, "Is this the woman who had the article in the paper about not making your children your life and that your spouse should be your life? If so, I totally agree with her philosophy. When one's children grow up, they leave to have their own families."
That's absolutely true. I mean, I think that's the truth about motherhood, is that if you do your job well, it is an unrequited love. Like, you mean, yes, your children will love you, but if you do your job well, you create these beings who can go out into the world and be independent and not be attached to your every, you know, to your apron strings. And you know, you create this, that you create an unrequited love for yourself. And they were so curious. And we were talking about when I was on Oprah, there was one woman who said to me, look, you know, I have them for 21 years and then they're going to be gone and my husband will still be there. And I thought, really? I mean, you know, you're putting a lot of faith in the consistency of that marriage, that it's going to survive 21 years of drought. But that's why, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I feel like it's my responsibility to really work on this marriage and make sure that it blossoms all the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. To Raleigh, North Carolina, Lonnie, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'm not sure the ages of your children, but as a woman who's been passionately in love with my husband for 30 years and have enjoyed the ups and downs of a marriage as we've grown together, I'm beginning to understand a possible resentment as my children age into adulthood, into their marriages and love relationships of their own, that they resent this relationship that their father and I had. While very proud of it while they were children, and they looked around them and saw many divorces among their peers, there appears to be a resentment, as I mentioned, as they've aged into adulthood. And I wondered if the author could make a comment on this, dependent on her research.
You know, sometimes I wonder whether my kids will feel, you know, if they don't find a life partner about whom they feel passionate in the same way that my husband and I feel about each other. You know, I think that's a danger. You know, I definitely did get letters in the wake of the essay from a few letters from people who said my parents had that same kind of bond, and it has prevented me from ever finding anybody because I wasn't willing to settle. But, you know, I'm not sure. Yes, that's a danger. But I think in the long run, whether, you know, there's that famous book out, I don't remember the author, about settling, that women should learn how to settle. And I'm just not sure that that's really what we need to look. Is it better to be in a relationship that's emotionally unsatisfying than to be by yourself? I know a lot of women in their 50s and 60s and 70s who are never married, who've been very, very happy and professionally successful and emotionally content and have made, you know, satisfying lives without a partner. I'm not sure that to say that it would be better for them to have made a decision that was unsatisfying emotionally.
Here's another perspective on that. John writes, when I was 11, my mom and I had one of our many important and deep conversations in this, when she told me she loved me and my brother very much, but that my dad was and always would be first in her life. At that moment, a great sense of warmth and security flowed over me. How right that seemed to me at the time, and I have believed her priorities were spot on down to this very day, a couple of months short of completing 68 trips around the sun. And
great.
That's from John.
Thank you, John.
Okay, and let's go now to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Annie. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, as I commented earlier, I find it refreshing that your guest had the courage to admit to the world that she does, in fact, care for her husband more than her children. Because in that admission, I think she might have the opportunity to commute and to model to her children what a healthy marriage relationship can develop into.
I think that's a wonderful comment.
Absolutely. Thank you, Annie. I hope so. I really do hope that that's the model that we give them.
All right. 10-2 Donald in Silver Spring, Maryland. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for another wonderful, excellent program. I wanted to comment to your guest with some of the things that she had mentioned in this novel about family relationships in the aftermath of a tragedy like that. My family experienced something somewhat similar. My older brother died in an auto accident hit by a drunk driver.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Just a matter of a few months before he was to be married.
Oh.
And one of the things that I have noticed and I've had to deal with, and I think other family members have dealt with also, is certainly I've dealt with my brother's place in the family and my place in the family, and how his absence from the family has affected me, and I think affected the perception of ourselves within the family, and also maybe the way other people perceived us as well. There's been quite a bit as far as grief, certainly that my family went through. But I think some of the negative aspects of the relationship that I had with my sister, who is older also, and my younger brother are things that that I've had to deal with, and in a way, several of us have had to deal with.
Yeah, it's sort of coming to a different understanding. It changes the mm-hmm. landscape totally.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, when there's no more room to push things under the rug, when your emotions are so raw, then anything, you know, it's almost like nothing else, and nothing is off limits. You can express anything. And I think that's, you know, why we were talking about earlier, why so often marriages don't survive, because things that you might have been willing to sort of push aside or deny, when you are emotionally so devastated and so raw, you're not, you know, you are willing to tell the truth about everything. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's so hard to make it through to the other side. But something that I think is also true is that if your marriage can make it through to the other side, if your family relationships do survive you know, the various cycles of grief, then they can be stronger.
Absolutely. To Winnetka, Illinois. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, in hearing the description of Iris, I'm actually trying to decide whether I want to read this book. I'm an avid reader. I'm one of those strong women. I don't know the dominant. I am a feminist. I've had the change your name argument with every one of my children and others. Diane, you seemed horrified at how dominant Iris was. My question is she so negative? Is she not likable? I have a hard time when women characters... Will we understand her? Will I understand her? Will I like her?
I can tell you from my own personal reading of the book that Iris is fully human. Iris has her controlling moments, and watching her evolve is instructive. It's not negative. How would you describe her?
My publisher is now spinning in horror. I really wanted to write like I said, Iris is me in many, many ways, and that's some of that is negative, but a lot of that is really positive. I mean, the thing about Iris is that she cares. She cares so much,
and she grows
absolutely. And she's also a fundamentally decent human being and a fundamentally generous human being. And there are moments of, you know, she takes on the responsibility for this young girl who's Jane's grandniece,
exactly, about whom we've not talked,
right? This Samantha, who's an adoptee from Cambodia, who is a violin prodigy, and it's Iris and Iris's father who really makes this girl, who allows this girl to blossom, and their relationship, the relationship between Iris and this little girl, is it's an incredibly warm and loving relationship, and I think you really see what Iris is capable of. I mean, just to write a character who's, you know, mean, horrible, and then nothing ever happens to her, that's not interesting. I wanted to write a real character who you could see both the positive and the negative.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Milford, Michigan. Good morning, Doug.
Hey, good morning, Diane. I want to tell you what a great show. Thoroughly enjoyed listening. And
Doug, Doug, may I ask you, are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not on a speakerphone.
Oh, okay. It sounds okay. Go right ahead.
I am sitting in a lobby, so I'll step outside maybe, and you won't get as much feedback.
Okay, that's helpful. Go right ahead, because we're very short on time.
I just wanted to say thank you for a great show, and Ayelda, I really enjoyed your comments on marriage and
your
husband. Coming from the male's perspective, which is probably a little more unusual, I too believe that having that commitment and love of your spouse is much more important than your children. Your spouse should be there forever, but I think one of the things that we miss, and I'd like to get your perspective on it, is that, you know, that long-term marriage just doesn't happen. There's a lot of work and planning and commitment involved, and you talked about transferring the passion from your spouse to your children, and really it should stay with your spouse, and it should be a little more integrated, where you spend time with both but never lose your focus. Can you kind of tell how you've done that in your life?
Well, I think that, you know, marriage, a long-term marriage requires incredible amount of work. I mean, I think we all expect, we have this vision of, you know, you fall in love and it's going to be perfect and easy, and that if it's true love, it'll be easy love. And I don't think that's true. I think that true love demands effort and focus and attention. And if I want to model anything to my children, it's that. It's that if you want to make your life with someone, then you have to devote yourself to working on it.
And as one who's been married for more than 50 years, I can tell you that I agree with everything you've said, and that getting through the disappointments, mm-hmm. getting through the lack of feeling at times, mm-hmm. getting through all of that and holding on is worth it for some, and for others, it may not be the best thing in the world. Thank you for being here. I yell at Waldman. Her book is titled Red Hook Road. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Cambodia asking, how do you predict the future?
The Brahmin blessed the two oxen of the king mayor and then directed the oxen to Savanthresh.
This is Mr. Savanthun, president of the Cambodian Buddhist Temple in Silver Spring, Maryland. He's talking about the royal plowing ceremony, which is held annually.
On the fourth day of the waning moon of the sixth month of lunar calendar.
Or what we call early May. Tun says five pavilions are set up near the palace, and six oxen are walked around the area three times. After the king's oxen are led to the seven golden trays, things get interesting.
The first tray have rice, and the second tray contain corns. The third is beans. The fourth is sesame seed. Fifth is grass, and the sixth is water. And the seventh tray have alcohol.
The ceremony, a hybrid of Buddhism and Brahmanism, hasn't changed in 700 years.
So it's a ritual way to predict the future, to warn about the calamities in the country, or to predict a good harvest.
The oxen can eat from any tray, but their choices have consequences. Here's how it works.
Now, if the oxen eat, if it rice, they forecast that the harvest of the rice will be abundant. If it eat corn or sesame seeds or beans, they predict that the harvest of those grains will be abundant. Okay. Now, if they drink water, they have abundant water also, and they will have a peaceful nation.
Things get a little tense with grass, which means disease will spread. But the real trouble comes just where you'd expect it.
So when the oxen drink alcohol, it's a trouble. That means they predict that the nation will be at war or will be in turmoil.
What if they choose everything?
I guess we predict it that way. You say, oh, there's abundance of these grains and also there are a lot of rain. But